Okay. So we have some more fun and games from the box, the basket case questions.
Where's the basket gone? No basket today. Ha ha. Oh, you got it. Oh dear. Yeah, well, fun over here. Okay, here we go to see what weird and wonderful stuff we got in here. Oh, jeepers. Anyway, these are yesterday's ones, so they go there first. Da-da-da. Ajahn Brahm, can you please briefly explain again what is the doer part of the mind? It was the one who wrote that question. I was thinking of walking as mindful as I can along the woods. Is it okay if I start that these for a few days or later, past the retreat, when my mind is more calm? You can walk any time. In fact, you've already been walking from here to your hut to the toilet. So walking meditation is fine any time. You just balance the sitting meditation, the walking meditation. I should have really explained a bit about walking meditation. Very, very simple. Is just be aware, be kind, and walk. That's simple. But people say, what do I do? Just be aware, in the present moment. Remember what I said, whatever is in front of you right now is the most important. And be kind. I'll give a bit more instructions tomorrow, because I was going to, for those of you having a hard time doing nothing, it's amazing, isn't it? I can't believe it. But I'll give some instructions, how to do a few little things, a bit extra, in case you're having a bit difficulty. And I'll also do the walking meditation tomorrow. Can you please help me understand why we inherit some characters and traits from our parents? Recently I found myself putting my fingers across my mouth when I think. I never used to do this. I haven't lived with my mother for years and never did it when I did live with her. My bad dad noticed and told me to stop doing it. I seem to have inherited little subtleties from her. It is super strange. Would you know some things are just inherited? Thank you. It is only day one and I love China Grove. Yeah. Day two or three, it's okay. Day four, five or six, you might start hating China Grove. No, you love it. It's a good place. So while you have character traits, I don't know that sometimes, you know, even when you were very, very young, you saw that imprinted on your brain. You know, we are creatures of habit. You know, and so because of that, we get the habits from other people. You know, you see me when I sort of talk to people, I, you know, always say very good and carry on. And, you know, some of my talks, I say that when I was a young monk, and this evening, I saw one of the other monks saying, oh, when I was a young monk, they're sounding like me. So sometimes we do tend to imitate one another. That's just the characteristics of human beings. But the nice thing is, if you hang out with good people, then you imitate their goodness. Which is why the Buddha said association with good people is a great blessing. You know, I told you the elephant sort of story from the Jataka tales a few days ago. If the elephant hangs around with good people, it starts to imitate the good people. You know, monkey see, monkey does. None he see, none he does. A little joke, that's going to get me for the afterwards. Anyway, so this is just the imitation, which we understand that works. That's conditioning, brainwashing. And so it's just you've hung out with your mother for a long time, and of course some of the character traits are going to come up. That's just natural. So it's the same with all the influence, and the point of it here is make sure that you associate with good people and try and avoid bad people. And if you do that, then you don't take on bad people's character traits. Sometimes I have some very beautifully profound meditations. Other times I have some quite difficult ones. Could you talk about your experiences on this? It's par for the course. So when it's beautiful ones, you know, that's the paycheck. When it's the difficult ones, that's when you're doing the work. Okay, so you can't expect every meditation to be wonderful and beautiful. And it's nothing to do with you, it's just cause and effect. You may be sick, you may be tired, you know, you may be, I don't know, eating the wrong food, whatever it is. And so there's many, many causes which have to come together to get really nice meditations. and sometimes those causes aren't there. But again, you don't measure the meditations, good ones, bad ones. That is the problem. They all have to be jhanas. And you know, that's actually what this one person, he was only making it up. I asked him years and years ago at a meditation retreat, how's the meditation? No, it's really terrible. So why? I said, I can only get second jhana, I can't get third. That's crazy. You know, he wasn't getting any jhanas, but that's what he thought. If you get a jhanas are brilliant. Just get one jhana and you'll be happy for the next year. But, you know, sometimes we have all this craving. And when we want more, this is the old saying, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So the reason it was a difficult meditation, because you wanted something more. So, okay. If I persist through my defining thought patterns, I can break on through to some nicer states of mind. Or is it I'm trying too hard? You're trying too hard? Now, the two types of meditation. I usually say this on the first talk. There are two types of meditation. And don't think samatha vipassana. That's not what I mean at all. The two types of meditation are called Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. Second Noble Truth, craving leads to suffering. So when you have difficult meditations, those are called Second Noble Truth Meditations. You are suffering. Why? Because you've been craving and wanting something. That is the cause of suffering. That means the difficult meditations, you've been wanting something. You've been doing the wrong type of meditation. Whenever you suffer, you're upset, unhappy, you don't like the meditation, it's because you wanted something. That's the cause. That's basic Buddhism, Second Noble Truth. And I wouldn't recommend Second Noble Truth meditation. I would recommend Third Noble Truth meditation. Letting go leads to the bliss of Nibbana. If you're having a happy time, you're peaceful, you're content, wonderful. You've done Third Noble Truth meditation. You've let go. So when you've had difficult meditations, it means you've been wanting something. Stop it. Now that is deep, profound. Because whenever you're meditating and you're not happy, you're not sort of content, don't use force. I'm going to push through this, as that question said. Don't ever use willpower. In meditation, use wisdom power. What do I mean by wisdom power? If you're not having a peaceful time, it's because you're wanting something. Ask yourself, what is it I want? What do I want? And then you'll soon find out what it is you want. And that is the problem. As soon as you see it, it's an amazing thing in Buddhism, in meditation. As soon as you see what the problem is, it's gone, it vanishes. And then you go deeper in meditation, have a wonderful time. Because this is the meaning of that simile of this character in Buddhist cosmology called Mara. And those of you who have read suttas or heard talks of this guy Mara, he always tries to disturb people meditating because he doesn't want them to be free. And the monk or the nun recognizes, I know you, Mara. That's all you need to do. Wisdom. I know you, Mara. And Mara thinks, oh God, the nun knows me, the nun knows me. And he has to leave with his head bowed, his shoulders drooping. The nun knows me. Mara is always conquered by wisdom, never by force. And that's the simile for the problems in meditation. The Maras, the obstacles which stop you getting deep in meditation. You don't fight Mara. You know Mara. I mentioned this with that story of Ajahn Mara and Ajahn Mahabua years ago, when Mahabua got up during a fever and fought the physical sensations. And Ajahn Mara said, that's not Buddhism. You don't fight your body. You understand it. Contemplate it. Wisdom power. And this is exactly what we do with problems in meditation. You're having a bad meditation, so you think, okay, you call it bad meditation, you're not happy. Don't force. Investigate. What is it you want? You want something. You may be, I want to be peaceful. I want to see nimittas. I want to go on to the next stage. That wanting is the obstacle. You'll be doing Second Noble Truth meditation. You see it, don't want anything. This is good enough for me. I just be sleepy. I don't want to sort of change it. I'm caring for myself, not curing this moment. And then when you don't want anything, then things start to happen. You're doing Third Noble Truth meditation. You're letting things be. And then it's sort of like the simile this morning. The lotus opens. The problem's gone. That is how it's solved, not through force. Now, how many times have I used force? An absolutely ridiculous, stupid monk. And I just want to make sure you don't waste so much time. Third Noble Truth. No wanting. And as I said at the beginning, when you want something more, that's why you can't enjoy what you already have. So when you don't want anything, you can enjoy this moment. You don't need much to have fun. Nice and sleepy, having a great time. Thank you very much, because I don't want anything. I hope you get the message. Next question, how can we care without doing the caring? Great question. How can we investigate without doing the investigation? Does knowing by itself fulfill both these functions? Also, please, could you expand on the relationship between caring and investigation? Thank you for knowing how to care and giving us some Dhamma talks, etc., etc., etc. Okay, that's what they've got here, etc., etc., etc. So, doing with caring without doing the caring. So what? I'm going to give the example now. Peace. 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 Can you feel it now, the peace? The words are pointing you in a direction of what the word means. The word is the signpost. It's not the thing. Once a person, I gave this simile in Dharmasara the other day. Once a person asks, which way to the toilet? And they say, it's just round the corner there. And so they got to this door, and the door had written on it, toilet. So they peed on the toilet door. That's what it said. It said toilet. That's mistaking the signpost for the thing. It says toilet. It means inside. Over there is a toilet. You know, when you see the sign, Perth. That's not Perth, the sign. It's pointing to where Perth is. Peace is the sign. What happens afterwards is the thing. So, caring. Caring. Now you are caring. You're not doing the caring. Doing is giving all the instructions. Come on, care. Ajahn Brahm said, I must care. That's okay, you must care. Okay, are you caring? No, you're not caring enough. Care some more. Care, care, care. That is doing the caring. It's okay every now and again just to give a little signpost. And tell your mind, just one of the signposts I love doing is just telling myself, okay, come on, calm down. And then I give the mind a long time to be able to follow the instruction. I don't say, come on, calm, calm, come on, calm, come on, calm. It's like, you know, working in the kitchen. You say, come on, wash your dishes. Come on, wash your dishes. Wash your... No, I'm doing the dishes. Shut up. And that is your mind, okay, telling you, shut up, look, I'm doing it. I'm doing the caring. Why can't you be quiet and let me do the caring? Or let me do the, you know, be caring. You are the doer. That's the problem. That's what I mean by how you actually care without doing the caring. How you investigate without doing the investigation. So get the idea there, and then you'll be a wonderful meditator. To care and to let go seem to me mutually exclusive. Please explain how to reconcile in meditation. Simple answer, that lovely story from my father, opening the door of your heart story. It's my definition of caring, compassion, love, kindness. When he still told me, son, wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, the door of my heart is always open to you. That's care. The letting go part of that is whatever you do, wherever you go, there are no strings attached. The care being the default always there, so you don't have to do it. You let it be. And so that definition of love is also a great definition of letting things be. You tell your son, son, now I'm your mum, I'd always love you and care for you, the door of my heart's always open for you. So you don't have to do anything. I'm not going to control you. I let you be. So that is how letting be and caring all come together. You care for the thing without controlling it, unconditionally. And the simile is, just like the sun shines on everybody, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it doesn't discriminate. And that's the same with loving kindness. It lets things be. It doesn't do things and control things. It's just kind without sort of controlling. That is caring and letting be. In fact, real loving kindness, real letting go are precisely the same. No difference at all. Dear Anton, there is one monastic you forgot to introduce last night. A real brownie and fluffy one. What has Teddy got to teach us? He's actually two now. So this other one came a bit late on the retreat, because probably came over from another country. So we've got two teddy bears. This one is a really big, big fellow. But this, what we do, the small one is probably the best. You can have that small one. Because we do teddy bear meditation. And so you put it in your lap, and then just cuddle it nicely, and just put your hands there, and just then you start meditating. Now, psychologically, teddy bears are soft, kind, caring. They bring back memories from your childhood when things were nice and simple, uncomplicated. And it's really nice. It's got a really nice texture. It's really soft and gentle. And so straight away, you can start getting the caring into your meditation. Sometimes after a few days, your meditation might be a bit dull and a bit hard. Oh, another day to meditate. Do teddy bear meditation. Put it here and meditate. Your meditation will be so much easier. The reason is we don't have enough care and kindness in our meditation. In fact, we fight our mind. And because of that, and we're so cruel to ourselves, so unforgiving, you put a teddy bear in your lap and you meditate, your meditation gets much, much deeper. It's really easy. And it was actually in Hong Kong that somebody brought their teddy bears to the meditation retreat many years ago. And I explained how to use them. And there were two teddy bears. They were people fighting to get them to do teddy bear meditation. There was always, the two of them were sort of, you know, were nabbed by somebody. It actually works. So the two of them are here. This one is probably the nicest one because it's nice and small. That's a bit heavy. Those are the tough guys. But these ones over here, try it out. I guarantee that you will have a wonderful meditation if you do the teddy bear meditation. Those are really nice. I don't want to give it away. So it just softens the mind. And when it gets a little bit softer, not hard, meditation is beautiful. So those are the two teddy bears. Thank you for deeper responses at last night's Q&A. It was refreshing, especially when you responded that the people in brown are supposed to practice not creating identity, but rather renouncing these notions of self and defilements, especially since they are ordained for the purpose of ending existence in this very life. How do you and other monks and nuns ensure they don't create and cling to another ego identity of, look at me, I am a monk, I'm an expert in non-self? Thank you for the brilliant
teachings that lead to peacefulness and freedom. Come to a place like Australia. Because when in Australia, most Australian monks, they look at monks or nuns and they think, we're really weird. Why do you have to shave all your hair off? You're a girl, you're supposed to have hair, long hair. It's okay for guys, you know, we like Bruce Willis, but you guys, girls, they think that you must have done some sin. Because in the ancient days, they would shave women's hair as a punishment. And now, monks, why are you wearing girls' dress? So it's wonderful when you go out, you know, in Perth or, you know, Sydney or whatever, dressed in your monk's robes. Because people, they don't respect you. Sometimes they try and challenge you to see what you're made of. Like, oh, I love these stories. It's great fun being a monk, honestly, because, you know, you have some weird experiences which, you know, you'll never have. So, long time ago, driving in a combi van, you know, the old Volkswagen vans, on a hot summer's day in Perth, all the windows open, and I remember it was down Leach Highway, you know, big highway, three lanes, came to a red light, I was in the passenger seat with the window open, you know, because no air conditioning, and then this car of, you know, young guys, maybe 18, 19, 20, you know, messing around, having a nice time together, they pulled up right next to me. They're the 19 or 20 Australian guys, and they shouted at me, hey, hey, have a look at this. And they had a magazine, and they were looking at. It was Playboy magazine. They were just having a bit of fun and games. No, they knew I was a monk, you know, celibate. Hey, have a look at this. And they were trying to sort of, you know, get me upset or something. And I just laughed my head off. And then, of course, and they laughed too, and then we drove away, and that was fine. Did I look? No, I'm a good monk. So how did I notice Playboy magazine? Because the driver looked, and he told me. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So when you have things like that, I mean, you can't get proud, you know, if you come to Australia. Now, over, you know, when you go to Indonesia or Thailand, places like that, you can get so proud. You really think that you're royalty. And well, that's one important thing. That's why over here, you know, sometimes I mess around. I open the doors for you. You know, I love playing like that. Because you can't, you're a senior monk. You can't do that for me. Why not? Good fun. So this is actually how you try and sort of, as a monk, especially, you know, in my position now, trying to deliberately sort of, you know, lower my sort of royal status. And it's great being in Australia, because if I did really get up myself, you know, you would all sort of straight away, you'd drag me down. Straight away you do that. Because, you know, you realise it's a danger. And it is a danger, not just being a monk, but being a senior monk, a famous monk, because the Buddha said, gains honour and fame. He said, they are the great dangers to monks and to nuns. Gains, they give it all away to other people. I work my butt off, but you've seen my cave, you know, I don't have anything in there, so it all goes to other groups. Well, that's nice. I can actually help other groups. Honour. Have I got any honours? Actually, I was made a Chow Khun by the King of Thailand. But, no, the fan is, where is it? It's over, it's in the hall somewhere, round the back. No one can see it. So, you know, no one even knows that I've got that. What else have I got? Sorry? Curtin medal. Yeah, where is that? I think it's in the hall. Is it behind the books in the library somewhere? So that's actually how you deal with fame and stuff. Yeah, okay, it makes other people happy, and then you just hide it away somewhere. Because that's not who you are. So, and fame, when you have fame, you also have infamy as well. The more famous you are, the more people are going to criticize you, like they're doing in Singapore right now and all other places. Of course it's going to happen. That's par for the course. So you just let it go. So in the end, it doesn't matter what other people think of you. And that's what you understand about yourself. Which means that, you know, there's no one there to be a target. If there's any remnant of a self left in there, you're a target. You can get upset. Praise and blame. And they will always come together. And you can't just have one without the other. So that's why I said this morning, always remember the simile of the lotus. Chanel number 5, you're in on it. You accept both. And it all falls off and leaves no residue. So sometimes people say, you are the most wonderful monk in the whole world. And the next day they say, you are the most arrogant, proud, stuck-up monk in the whole world. You know, you think you're going to change Thailand with your bhikkhunis. You are just schismatic monk, or whatever they say. And just like Chanel number 5, urine off a lotus. So that's how you have to practice. Because if you do have an ego, you are going to suffer. So it's very hard. And other monks and nuns too. Just because you're in robes does not mean that you have, what's the word? You have rights, you have privileges. You have to earn those. And you have to do earn those in the West. It's given in Asia. You know, people look at you in Asia, Sri Lanka, even Singapore, Malaysia. You are respected just because you're wearing the robe. Over here, no, you have to work for it. You have to earn it over here. Which is great. That's why it's great that monks actually do come to places like Australia. If you say something, the monks will question, the people question you afterwards. Ajahn Brahm, you can't say that. Because it says in Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta 64, verse 2, it says, you never do that in Sri Lanka, question a monk. But it happens here, and that's really healthy. And you have to do that. You question the nuns, you question the monks, anybody. And if you don't do that, you're destroying Buddhism. And the monks get away with things. I remember, as a young monk, you know, in Thailand, you know, I went to this place and they asked me to give a talk. I said, I can't speak Thai. They said, no, give a talk. You want to hear Western monk, give a talk. But I don't know how to say anything. Well, give a talk. So, okay, I gave a talk. And after I gave the talk, all the people there said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And then afterwards, I understood, did you understand any of that? No, we didn't understand any of it. I can speak Thai. But just because you're a monk, they say sadhu. And they can speak absolute rubbish, and they still say sadhu, sadhu. And the problem is, you know, if monks weren't smart, they'd think, wow, that was a really good talk I gave. They all said sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And so, you know, monks actually get, because they always get praise, they never get any criticism or blame. It means sometimes they think they really are something. Be careful. Please don't treat your monks like royalty. We're supposed to be simple. And number 2, don't spoil the monks and nuns by giving them too many things. You know, even in Indonesia, it was, you know, Handika's mum. You know, she said, oh, I noticed you haven't got a BlackBerry. You haven't got a mobile phone. I want to get, can I buy you a BlackBerry, a mobile phone? No way. But, no way. But. I like a simple life. What do you want a mobile phone for? I've got one of those Samsung Galaxy tablets, and that gives me enough suffering. I don't want any more with emails and stuff. But so somebody else wanted to get me a new Angsa, because they said my stomach is pushing out above my Angsa. I don't know who that was. But, no, my old one is good enough. What's wrong? You know, I've got a stomach. I'm a human being. What's wrong with that? I'm not going to sort of, you know, be a sort of like a model in a, you know, just
the getting really nice stuff. It just, this is me, this is how I am. You're going to have to live with this. You know, sometimes I had a rip in my robe in Hong Kong. So we just, you know, just stitch it up. He said, oh, we can get you another robe. I said, no, just stitch it up, a patch, that's good enough. I said, no, you're seeing a monk. No, patches. Just like in the time of the Buddha, for goodness sake. And these robes, whatever, you know, you find there, you don't sort of, you know, you want this robe. What's the quality of the cotton? I don't want to say. You know, the colour is just, you know, not really me. But any old robe will do. So it's really important that you don't spoil the monks and the nuns too. So they've got enough, there's sensible stuff, enough robes, a place to stay, enough food which, you know, is good for their tummy. And they don't think you know the best, because every monk, every nun has their own, you know, needs for what they have to eat to keep themselves without stomach ache. So, you know, you look after the nuns and the monks, food, and anything else they need, medicines, but don't overdo it. Because sometimes monks, they do get spoiled. And nuns too. And that destroys Buddhism. What was that Lumpur Nenkam? He was in the newspaper, he had his own private jet. And they had a picture of him in a private jet with these bags from Louis Vuitton and other stuff. He's supposed to be a monk, for goodness sake. And so that goes a bit too far. Okay, I listen to your talks for some time now and notice you are very skillful in hypnotic speech and planting suggestions. Yes. You will give a donation after this retreat. You will give... Okay, joke. There was a monk, and he started a temple, and it was so difficult, you know, to get enough donations, you know, to pay the bills, the electricity and everything else. So he's really finding it hard, you know, because he's just a young monk just starting out. So he went to see one of these old monks and said, "No, can you help me out?" I said, "Look, I'll give you some advice. What I did when I was young, next time you give a sermon, close all the windows, make it really stuffy, turn up the heater so it's really warm, and give a boring talk, which is what you're very good at, and in a low monotone like this, because if you speak like this, people will fall asleep. But just before they fall asleep, get out, you know, your watch, backwards and forwards, hypnotize everybody, and then, when they're all hypnotized, you tell them, when you leave, give a donation in the donation box. No coins, no 5s, 10s, or 20s, only 50s and 100s. And the most... I can't do that, that's fraud. No, it's not, it's good karma. So he gave it a try. And it worked. Now the donation box was full of, you know, $100, $50 notes, no coins. He really cleaned up. But next time he needed some money, he couldn't do it every week because people will soon discover what's happening. So the next time he needed some money, he did the same trick, closed all the windows, made it stuffy, turned up the heaters, gave a boring sermon when the people were about to be asleep, just in a hypnotic state. He got out his watch and is about to, you know, to tell them what to do, and he dropped his watch. And he said, "Oh, shit." And that's exactly what they did. And it serves him right. That is fraud. That's it. Hypnotism to raise funds joke. It doesn't work. Well, anyway, plenty of suggestions. Is that why there are so many monks at the monastery? I've hypnotized them. You will become a monk. Implanted to join the Buddhist cult. You can hypnotize a person so far, but, you know, in the end, you know, that people actually join big monastery or a nunnery because they really feel it's a beautiful lifestyle. And all of the teachings, you know, they can be inspiring, but it's the example of young men and young women actually devoting their lives to spiritual paths, you know, giving it full commitment. And you know, for many, it's not easy. For me, it was easy. I was a natural monk. You all know that. My story was when I first became a monk in Thailand, the first week I had nightmares. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, just after I'd been ordained as a novice monk. I woke up with nightmares. Now, night after night after night. And my nightmare was that I was a layman. I thought I was a layman in my sleep. And I woke up in a sweat. And I opened my eyes, I saw my robes next to my bed on the floor. I'm a monk, I made it. And I closed my eyes and go into really deep, comfortable sleep. And that really told me that, you know, deep down, just how much I'd inclined and really wanted to be a monk. You know, that was, you know, subconscious revealing itself to me. So I've always been a very happy monk. This is really what I wanted to do. And it's over 40 years now. So that's a long time being a monk, but that was because I liked it and I wanted it. Other people, they join being a monk or a nun, and they give it a try, because being a monk or a nun, you can always leave. Now, without any stigma, you give it a try. And it's all the monks and nuns, or not so many nuns because they haven't just started over here, all the monks, you know, who disrobe over here, you know, they still come over here, and they are well known, all my disciple monks who disrobe, of being excellent husband material. Isn't that right, Kanchana? Because she got one of my monks. So, you know, I train them, you know, to be really soft, lots of loving kindness, you know, just being sensitive and mindful. And then, you know, they're okay, we've had enough of that. But the girls, okay, just disrobe. And it's true, that all these women, they come up to me and they say, thank you for training my husband. They're the best. That's a creme de la creme. So, I don't know any monks. Actually, there was a couple of disrobed recently, but I won't tell you where they are, otherwise to go hunting them down. But it's okay. They give a try. They give everything they've got. Well done. So it's not a stigma, it's a beautiful thing, and they get a lot out of that, you know, in life. Where's Dania? She got one of mine as well. Where's she gone? Around the corner. Mike. So that's great. So you can be a monk and nun for a short time, give it a try, and if it works, wonderful. If it doesn't work, sort of, okay, wonderful too. Jaguar, he's over in Chicago. Yeah, he just emailed him. Sorry? Yeah, John Cienciosi. Yeah. So he emailed about a week ago. Just, you know, asked me when am I going over to Chicago. So, you know, we still keep in touch. So anyway, it's not sort of a cult. People can come and go whenever they want. And just, you know, you can ask the people who've been in the cult, you know. You know, your son-in-law and Mike just round the corner over here. Yeah, they can come and go, and they realise that, you know, it's a beautiful thing, and it's a lot of freedom. So they do it because they like it. Can you please elaborate on Ajahn Gunhar's teaching that samadhi is very important to enlightenment, but one should never forget about the significance of virtue? Can this teaching be relevant to the fact that some people have meditated for so long and seem to be a good... Oh, good meditators are not compassionate or skillful. Okay, now this, I actually asked someone to write this question because last night, or was it this morning? I think it was this morning. I said that even if you haven't got good virtue, you can still get into jhanas. Now that wasn't trying to demean the importance of virtue. That's really powerful and wonderful. All it was saying is that, you know, some of you, your five precepts may not be perfect, even maybe four precepts. Three, well... But don't feel down upon yourself, because you can even get jhanas. I was just trying to make sure that it's possible for everybody. It's easier if you have virtue, but you can do it. That was the purpose of this. So don't be so worried about, oh, I'm not a good person. How can I get jhanas? Yes, you can. Oh, I've just done so much bad stuff in my past. How can I do this? Yes, you can. So that was just encouraging you, opening the doors to the very highest in Buddhism. However, that wasn't to demean the importance of your precepts, because if you keep your precepts, you practice virtue, that gives you this incredible, powerful strength. As it first comes up, and actually just makes, because when you're keeping precepts, you're actually letting go of the bad stuff. All the precepts are about letting go of stuff. Yeah, you know, you'd like to sort of have sex with someone, but you say, no, I'm married, I won't. Yeah, you know, you like to sort of take something, you know, they won't mind, and they're charging too much for it anyway, so, you know, just, you can have all sorts of justifications for stealing, but, you know, you say, no, you have to resist the temptations. You know, sometimes, you know, the people leave money there. And can you resist the temptation? And, you know, sometimes that people don't. So it's always a letting go of stuff. You know, lying. Sometimes you tell the truth and you're embarrassed by telling the truth. It's a tough thing to do, but can you renounce your ego and pride and just say, yeah, I've made a stupid mistake? So it takes a lot of letting go to keep even five precepts. And it's the power of letting go, which is you train in your precepts, it makes it easier to let go when you're meditating. And then, when you start getting into the deep stuff, there's that stays the nimittas. I always like telling this because when a nimitta comes up the first time, then there's really the pure ones, the lights. Sometimes people's nimittas aren't bright. Sometimes they're like a dirty rag. You know, they're stained, like a moon, but also dirty and smudged. That is a sign that you've broken some precepts. You've been a bit cruel. You know, you've been nasty to somebody. Because this nimitta you're seeing is a reflection of your mind. And, you know, it does affect that mind. The first time I said that, I remember it was in Kuala Lumpur. And straight after the talk, this guy, can I talk to you please, Ajahn Brahm? Yeah, what's up? I had an nimitta and it was filthy. I remember this boy. And I said, well, what have you been doing? He said, that's the problem. Ajahn Brahm, I'm sorry. You can't hide it because, you know, the nimitta is right in front of you. And, you know, it does affect your mind. Other people, they're just so pure. They're always kind. They never say a bad word to anybody. They're always helpful. They never say, get out of here, it's none of my business. They're always there to assist, to help, generous. These are the people who work behind the scenes, never actually just wanting any acknowledgement. They just love to assist and help, and they're really trustworthy people. Those are, you know, what we call pure-hearted people. And those ones, when they get nimittas, wow. Brilliant, beautiful. Their virtue has been so pure that when nimittas come up, their mind is just brilliant, powerful, because of their virtue. This is where you get the first payoff from virtue. Nimittas are beautiful. The more kind, generous, compassionate you've been. And you see that. Now, when I said, well, even if you don't get your precepts, I know all the loopholes. Here is the loophole. So pay attention in case you get a dirty nimitta. Even if you haven't been keeping your precepts, you've been a bit naughty, a bit sort of upset. You're a human being. So, you know, you're not perfect. You're not an arahat, fully enlightened. So you will break precepts, say wrong things, think naughty thoughts or whatever. So what to do is, I'm like one of these lawyers who sort of know all the sort of the skillful means to get out of breaking the law. Out of being, not out of breaking the law, out of getting caught or getting prosecuted. So what you do is, you see this nimitta, smudge here, dirt over there. It's always part of the nimitta which is not smudged. A little bit which is clean, like a dirty rag. There's a part of it which hasn't been soiled. And you zoom in on that part, on the clean part. And then so it zooms in and all the dirty part goes, it's still a bit smudged. But then you zoom in on the beautiful part of the smudge part, and it gets more and more beautiful, more and more pure. And that's actually how you do it. So, yeah, you know, you've broken a few pieces, but you've also kept some as well. You don't look at the two bad bits in the wall. You look at the beautiful bits in the wall. So you don't have to have a perfect wall, and you can still get into the jhanas. That's basically how it works. But, you know, with that two bad bits in the wall story, it's amazing just how many people can't take their eyes off the faults. They're fault finders. And if you're a fault finder in life, you'll have a hard time practicing this loophole. And that's one of the problems. That's one of the reasons why. Don't be a fault finder. Just, you know, forgive the bad stuff and just focus on the good stuff. Don't collect the shit, collect the eggs in that story. And then what happens is, if you practice like that in your real life, when you actually get the limiters coming out, maybe a few smudgy parts, but straight away you'll go for the beautiful part. And you get into the limiters and jhanas really easy. So that's actually how it works. But it's best to keep your precepts. You're ahead of the game. Can you explain about walking meditation, process, benefits, etc.? I'll do more about walking meditation tomorrow. But I did a little bit this evening. But tomorrow morning I'll mention that. Can a stream winner be obtained by a lay person? If yes, would they know it or not? Yes, yes. Of course you can get at being a stream winner as a lay person. If you are, you'll know it because I'll give you a certificate. No, I don't give certificates. Being a stream winner is an event. It's, you know, something which the big kick up the backside, wow. You know, you're seeing things in a different way. You know, your whole world's turned upside down. You know, you understand, there's nobody in here. And the things which you thought were you, no longer you. Again, I'll mention more about this when I give the talk on insight. I've got a lot of these things. This is my storage cabinet. Ajahn, in meditation, I think I'm subtly rejecting the body. This is causing fatigue. How to deal with this, please? Look, go and take a rest. Every time you're fatigued, just, you know, go for a little walk, get some exercise, have a cup of tea or coffee if you like tea or coffee or orange juice or peppermint, whatever you like. Now, take a rest. So don't force the body. So if you're subtly rejecting it, it's like ill will. So tell the body, you know, develop some metta, loving kindness to your poor body. Ah, poor body. You can get your hand. If you feel like you're rejecting the body and you're getting fatigued, get your hand and stroke the body. Ah, body, I'm sorry, I shouldn't reject you. You know, I care for you. You've looked after me for 64 years. I'm going to look after you. There, Rajab Baba. Okay. Or even better, get teddy bear and do teddy bear meditation. Then you're not rejecting the body, you get soft. And then you won't have fatigue. So you need a little bit more loving kindness. And then you won't be rejecting the body and you won't get fatigue. So kindness, teddy bear meditation. Could you please say something about what real kindness actually is? I mentioned that, kindness. It's amazing the way the mind works. You say the word enough times and the mind moves towards what kindness actually is. Kindness is cuddling a teddy bear. Try that. Thank you for a very good talk this morning on meditation and the goal of meditation, jhana. On average, how many hours of serious practice is required before one can experience nimitta and jhanas? Only one moment. You can't count it in hours. And it's not even, you know, just the more hours you put in, the more likely it is you're going to get there. It's just, I call it pressing the letting go button. That is, you know, you mess around, letting go button, where is it? Maybe for years until you find the letting go button. Sometimes, you know, you just find it straight away. And you press the letting go button and it all happens really quickly. And you can't say how many years it takes to find the letting go button. You know, I've been teaching it, talking about it, and explaining it, but sometimes it takes a long time before the message gets in. Sometimes people have to have their back against the wall, you know, like Ananda, to press the letting go button. Sometimes, like there's one lady, she was on one of the retreats, the executive retreats in Khaolak some years ago. She was meditating and meditating and meditating, 9 days, getting absolutely nowhere. So at the end of the retreat, pretty much a waste of time. But when we formally ended the retreat, loving kindness meditation, photographs, bye-bye everybody, her taxi to take her to the airport was, you know, another hour. So she decided, well, nothing to do, might as well kill time, meditate. So she meditated for the first time just to kill time instead of trying to get jhanas. So it's just killing time. And after the hour of meditation, she came up to me. I was sitting on a chair. Thank you so much. She got her first deep meditation. And I love telling the story because 9 days wasting time trying to get meditation. And then she gave up. You know, enough. I can't do it. I'm hopeless. And she was just killing time. And that's when it happened. So now what you do, say, oh, really, that's easy? So, okay, I'm just going to, after I've finished, I'm just going to kill time for half an hour. It doesn't work. Because it's not really killing time. You expect, you're doing it to get something rather than just letting go. So you can't really tell how long. You have experienced jhana, you describe the experience of the most wonderful and happy experience. Can you experience states in almost all the meditations you now do? How often you experience per month, per year? Thank you. I said this in an interview, because sometimes people, they do ask the question, Ajahn Brahm, you always talk about jhanas, and you write books about them. Now, do you really know what you're talking about? Ajahn Brahm, be honest. Ajahn Brahm, can you experience jhanas? That's what people ask me sometimes. And I've got to be honest and open to you. And so I put my hand up and I say, hold my hand on my heart, Ajahn Brahm can't do jhanas. I can't do it. I can't at all. And then I say, because this is an important teaching, so Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first. And then the jhanas happen. It's not I do them. It's not I achieve them. This I business has to vanish. That's an important part of letting go. I have this beautiful saying, which I mentioned to a person when I said this. Ajahn Brahm vanishes, and then the jhanas happens. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. That's from Visuddhi Magga. Beautiful saying. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. You've got to vanish. Disappear. And as you disappear, little by little, and this vanishing trick, the art of disappearing, letting go, then the jhanas just happen. But I never do jhanas. The jhanas happen when I stop doing things. That's the core letting go. That's how it works. And it's important to understand that, because with this whole path of letting go and getting the jhanas, it also makes more sense of this teaching of the Buddha called anatta, non-self. When there's a self there, an idea of a self, a me, there's always doing things. That's what the self is. That's what its function is, to do stuff. But when the sense of self vanishes, that's when letting go happens. So the letting go button is actually disappearing. Vanishing, the sense of you disappearing and going. And when that goes, nothing to do. You can't do. There's no one to do the doing. No one to do the meditating. And then the jhanas happen. This is how you practice non-self. And this is the result of non-self. Of just imagining it, or just being it, and just giving it a try, experimenting with non-self. You get the jhanas. Whenever there's a self there, I am experiencing things. no jhanas. So that's why, you know, it's a nice way of saying, that's one of the reasons why, one of the monks' rules, and nuns' rules as well, the eighth paticca for monks, you are not permitted to tell lay people if you have a jhana or not. Why do you say that rule? It would be inspiring. You can't tell lay people whether you're enlightened or not. First I thought that was maybe to stop monks being proud or stuff, but it's much deeper than that. Because you can't tell anyone. There's no one who achieves these things. These are the total opposite of achievements. Disappearing, letting go, vanishing. In one of the suttas, I like quoting this one, I forget which one it is now. This monk comes up to the Buddha, and Ananda is listening. And he said, one who is fully enlightened, an arahat, never ever thinks they're better than anybody else, never thinks they're worse than anyone else, never thinks they're the same as anyone else. We say, yeah, exactly. And then another monk came up and said exactly the same thing. One who's an arahat, fully enlightened, never thinks they're better, worse, or the same as anybody else. Yeah, exactly. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, those are two arahats. That's how people tell me that they've attained. They never say, I'm an arahat. They say, there's no one there. I'm not better than anyone else, not the same as anyone else, not worse than anyone else. There's no one there. That's how you say you're an arahat. So anyone who says, I'm enlightened, yeah, sure. Could you read the question slowly so we know what they are? Thanks a lot. Okay, I'm only messing around, but yeah, I will try to. Sometimes there's so many questions, that's why I try to do them fast. So again, there's more questions here. So I have to start a rule that only one question per person per day. Okay? So if you've already written a question, you find a better one, you've got to dig out your old one, throw that one away, and to replace it. And when I say one person, one question, not like this, part one, part two, part three. I mean, one question. Can you clarify, most important time is now, understood. The most important person is one right in front of you. Isn't that person yourself? Of course it's not. This is what really impressed me when I first read this as a student. It's not me. It's the one right in front of you. So it's Ananda. You are the most important person in the whole world right now. But not anymore. That means you're mindful of the object. If you're always just, no, you're the most important person, you just get really stuck up. Most of the time in your life, though, that you're alone. So when I go into my room, yeah, now I'm the most important person. But a lot of times, you know, especially during interviews, I've been practicing training like this for years. You know, if you're right in front of me in the interview, I really work hard to make sure you feel important. And I really try this. You are the most important person in the world. So I really try and relate to you. When you ask your question, I'm really listening as much as deeply as I possibly can. You're important. You know, you managed to get here. And you've put your name down for an interview, and now you're interviewing in front of me. Imagine, I'm saying, oh, just, no, it's just Ananda, just, no, he doesn't matter. Just, okay, yeah, I'm not really paying attention. Okay, you can go now. That would really be awful. That would be so disrespectful. That would be just so un-Buddhist. So whoever's in front of me is always the most important. And if you do that, you'll be a very successful communicator. And show care and kindness to the person. Am I right? Yes. Care and kindness to whoever's right in front of you. And that was the Emperor's Three Questions by Tolstoy. But I extended that to meditation. And it's a beautiful way of looking at meditation. Close your eyes. Now's the most important time. Not sort of, you know, how long we have to stay. I want to go to bed. That is not the most important time is now. Now's the most important time. Wait for bed later on. It will come soon. The most important thing is I'm looking at this. Here's a nice light in my mind. That's really important for me. Even if there was tiredness, that would be the most important. whatever it else is there, is the most important. And I don't try and change it, get rid of it. I want to make it more brilliant light. I want to get rid of my tiredness. I care for it. I don't want to change my teddy bear. I just care for it. I don't want to say no, it should be a tiny bit bigger. Maybe not in my colour, it's got a bit of a hole in here. Maybe it needs surgery. Any doctors here? You've got a hole in there, look. But you care for it. And that is actually how you develop deep meditation. Dear Ajahn, I was sitting in my room this afternoon feeling tired and grumpy. Can you please make a sour face with your shoulders slumpy and a really dirty facial expression to show everybody first how I am feeling, Ajahn? Is that any good? I'll try my best. There was a heavy feeling on my head and my body felt gross. I asked me how I am feeling and I replied, bored. And I asked me what I feel like day one and I just replied, nothing. I sat there lost and confused. And then I remembered, I love me. I then wrote me a love letter telling me how lovely and sweet and cute I am, even when I'm tired and grumpy. After I sat there and loved me as I was until my eyes, dropped, and my golden love soaked through me. My eyes opened or dropped, drooped, or I can't read that word. And my golden love soaked through me. I heard my tummy gurgling with pleasure, something gurgling with pleasure, and I felt warm, protected, nourished and nurtured. I realized my own love counts and is very powerful. Is that warm golden glow I wanted for nothing? Ajahn, can you please show everyone a big soft smile to show how I felt? Try my best. P.S. I love you, Ajahn. You are so lovely. Lovely, sweet, and cute. P.P.S. I am a straight celibate male. P.P.S. I love you, and I go, and two, you are also, I love you all. Two, that's all of you guys and girls. You're also lovely, sweet, and cute. From a nice guy. Side, that's very nice, yeah. So that's wonderful. So it's a great way when you're really depressed. I really feel terrible, and you're just bored, and nothing to do. It's wonderful, write yourself a love letter. Or just, you know, get a little teddy bear to write you a love letter. It's beautiful. You know, one little trick I did, if you're really bored, I imagined, can use imagination, it's really easy. I imagined sitting down there, because instead of having a fantasy or getting grumpy, I imagined sending myself a present. You have a monk. When I was a young monk, no one would give me anything. And a senior monk, they give you too much. But when you're a young monk, you're a nun, you don't get anything. So I imagined finding an old shoebox and some wrapping paper and some ribbon and one of these little cards, gift cards. Getting it all together. Now, what can I give in this little box? And I imagine getting some, what do I really want? What I really want is some, say, contentment. And I imagine putting contentment in the shoebox. And I visualize this, putting contentment, lots and lots of contentment, so I couldn't find any more contentment in the box. And I put the lid on. And I imagined wrapping the box with the paper, you know, making nice little corners and just folding them and getting some sellotape and tying it down. And then getting a beautiful ribbon and tying a little bow on the end of the ribbon. And then getting the little gift card and writing on the gift card to Ajahn Brahm with love from Ajahn Brahm. And then in my imagination, I pushed the box aside and just thought about all sorts of things. And then, oh, there's a box there. And And I said, I wonder who that's for. And I looked, it's all imagination, playing around. Oh, it's to Ajahn Brahm, from Ajahn, how sweet. I wonder what's inside. And you don't rip it apart. You very carefully, because as a monk you have to do this because we recycle stuff. Especially in the old days when you didn't have anything. So you take the ribbon and very carefully untie it and just fold it away so you can use it again. And very carefully, you know, just take the sellotape off without ripping the paper. Then unfold it and fold the paper aside to use another time. And then you've got the box. And just like when I was a kid, all excited. I wonder what's inside. I wonder what's inside. And then, you know, you shake it. Wow, it's really full of something. I wonder what it is. And, you know, you get the anticipation going. And then you open the box. Contentment. Ah, that's just what I wanted. Thank you so much. And what that is actually doing psychologically, this thing, contentment, or self-respect, or forgiveness, whatever you really need, because you're going through this long imaginary process, and maybe 5 minutes, you know what's in the box from the beginning. You put it in there. You're reinforcing with your imagination the gift of forgiveness to yourself or contentment. And if you do that properly, you know, you can mess around with it yourself. It really works. Because instead of saying, I'll just forgive myself, it's a whole 5 minute, 10 minute ceremony. And it's a fun ceremony. And every time of that, every moment of that ceremony, you're reinforcing the message that I'm giving me forgiveness, I'm giving me forgiveness. And I find that, there it is. And then you can accept it. So those are nice little psychological things you could do. Just like writing yourself a love letter. And you can put anything in your box, what you really want for yourself. You know, respect. You know, maybe you're feeling very sick, I want some health. You know, I want to go to sleep tonight and have a good sleep, because sometimes people don't sleep well. So, good sleep. You put a good sleep in the box, a really good sleep in the box. And then you wrap it all out and just do all the things. Then, I wonder what it is. And you're having a good sleep. Ah, that's what I really, really wanted. Thank you so much. Then you have a good sleep. So that's a nice little trick for you. Okay. Dear Venerable Ajahn Brahm, after hearing the account of a husband who's searching for a mistress because his wife moved to another room. Okay, I couldn't. This is a bit sort of... sometimes, at least I am courageous answering such questions. And I work from compassion and wisdom. So, you know, sometimes people agree with me and they argue with me, but that's what I would do, and that's what I would advise. After hearing the account of a husband who's searching for a mistress because his wife moved to another room, I couldn't help share my story. Are you interested? Around 5 years ago, when I moved out of my husband's room to keep 8 precepts every day, he doesn't like this meditation business and was scared of losing me. But I didn't give up my path, neither did I try to take him in my path. But now, 5 years later, he, by force, sent me on this retreat. I didn't want to come because he had to finance me. He listens to Dharma, meditates and all that now. As far as I know, he didn't go in search of a mistress. As far as you know. No, he may not have done. He changed on his own, undoubtedly took a better turn than go in search of a mistress. I say we're a better couple as Kalyana Mitra than we were as husband and wife. Yes, some people that happens. But, you know, sometimes it doesn't happen. And so, you know, you just got to accept that you can't control other people and you can't make other people become like you. You just have to free them. And maybe just by example they may follow, but maybe take them more time, you know, to get to 8 precepts. But that worked. Well done. How to differentiate between real nimitta and imaginary nimitta? There's no need to distinguish because 99.9% of nimittas are real. But what is really fascinating to me is why people always think when they first see nimittas, oh, it's imaginary, it can't be real. It really just shows that people have no confidence in their abilities and they always think, not me. And one of the great things is when you get nimittas, they are real. So please, you know, get used to the fact that you can meditate. Now, have some bit more trust in yourself and respect to yourself. People have got such low opinions of themselves these days. They think, oh, not me. Monks and nuns, maybe. And these people have been coming to temples for 20, 30 years. Maybe they can. But not me. And then you get a nimitta and think, oh, it must be imaginary, not me. It is you. You've got a nimitta, okay? Celebrate it. And if you really have doubts, you think, I'm just imagining some light coming in from somewhere. Because of this, every time I go on Singapore Airlines, I always ask for the eye shades. And I've got a whole heap of them in the office, care of Singapore Airlines. So if, and also just one from Garuda. And so any Indonesian, you can have a Garuda one if you wish. And you put them over your eye shades, okay? So you put eye shades on. And when you see a light, it has to be a nimitta. You've got eye shades on. Can't be anything else. And that's what I keep them for. So if you have any doubts, now I'll give you some eye shades. And you'll still see the nimitta. And that will prove to you once and for all, this is real. Can one experience real nimitta even when the five senses are not fully shut? Yes, of course, I should have mentioned that. Because what is happening, and the reason why you can see the nimitta, I have to use my hands here, so I tell you, don't fall down. You got, this represents the five senses. This represents the mind. Most people, the five senses, they are much stronger than the mind. That's why you're just aware of the five senses. But on these retreats, because you are calm and quiet, not doing very much, it's a very simple retreat. We're subduing the five senses. At the same time, that energy is going into the mind. So the strength of the five senses is decreasing. The strength of the mind is increasing. And you get to the stage where they're about the same level. And that's when you start to see the nimitta. Five senses are still there, but the mind is strong enough now you can start to see lights. And then you continue subduing the five senses. The nimitta gets stronger and stronger. And then it's weird, but if you really get really strong mind states, that nimitta is there all the time, even with your eyes open. You have to eat your lunch, brilliant nimitta there, and you've got to eat your lunch through the nimitta. Honestly. But this is actually what happened. The mind is that strong. The nimitta doesn't go. And that's actually just what happens. The mind is really strong. And the senses are subdued. You're not indulging the senses. So they don't get much power. They're just really so soft. And that's when you see the nimitta. So yeah, you do see the nimitta while the five senses are still there. But only the real full powerful one and the five senses go. Do you imagine, I've been told if one keeps the Buddha's five precepts very well, one's mind could get still more easily into meditation. Exactly. My question is, if someone knows nothing about the Buddha's precepts, just lives and does whatever he feels right, can this person make progress in his meditation if he decides to do meditation? Yes, because I knew nothing about the five precepts when I started as a Buddhist. But I was meditating. And no one told me about the five precepts. And they came to me naturally. I was a vegetarian when I was a monk, when I was a lay person. I can do that because I was cooking my own food. I could do that really easily. And when I was a young kid, on the buses in London, I thought, if they don't ask for your fare, why should I give it to them? And I made more money because I was really poor and I could get more stuff from the tuck shop at school. So, a lot of times I would not pay the bus fare. That was stealing. But later on, when you started meditating, it didn't feel right. And so then what would happen, I'd be on the bus and they wouldn't ask for my fare. And I'd say, sir, you didn't ask for my fare. This is my fare. And you'd give it to them. And, that was just the honesty which came very strong. And when I was meditating, before, when I first went to college, just like everybody else, you go down the pub, very often you get drunk, especially in parties. And, that was crazy stuff you did as a student. But then one day I thought, what am I doing this for? It doesn't make any sense. So I gave up alcohol. I remember one of my friends, that's actually my cousin, he said, oh, you're not going to last. I'll bet you're a pound you're going to take alcohol again. And that was about 45 years ago. He still hasn't paid me the pound. So, I started keeping all the precepts. Yeah, I had girlfriends, but no, I'd only have one at a time. Honestly, that's enough suffering. They're really expensive in those days. Jeez. But, you know, so they were worth it. They were nice. So, and I remember going to the temple. It was a Thai temple in London. And, you know, I was meditating there. And they came up to me and said, you know, you've been coming here long enough. It's about time you took the five precepts. And this is absolutely true. I remember this. And I said, no, sir, what are the five precepts? I never knew what they are. And they said, oh, you know, not killing, not stealing, not committing adultery, not lying, and not sort of taking alcohol or drugs. You know what I said? You know, cheeky, because, you know, my respect was not as strong as when it's embedded in you by your culture. I said, so I don't need to take the five precepts. I've been keeping them for over a year now. And I walked away. So I never took them, because I was keeping them. What do you want to take them for if you already have them? And that's how I learned my five precepts. It was natural. So that's why, you know, as long as you're keeping the five precepts, you know, you get nice meditation. And you don't need to be told. It's just common sense. Sometimes people meditate, like I started meditating. I was still drinking when I was meditating at first, but after a while, it didn't feel right. The wisdom, the insight came up. This is not right. I don't need them anymore. Same with the drugs as well. This was the late 60s and 70s. A lot of my friends were taking marijuana. But I said, it didn't feel right. You know, my meditation, it stopped me from getting into that simply because I didn't need it. I had enough sort of peace and happiness. I didn't need any artificial stuff. So, no, thank you for the Buddha from stopping me going down that path. So, anyway, that's what happens. Precepts are common sense when you're wise. On my meditation today, I have experience with breath, with image, and all my meditation. I felt breath was captivating and joyful, but I cannot get rid from images. I have great kindness and compassion with all the images. I felt mixed experience. I let go for it at the stages where I carry, and at the stage I felt tired, but I felt good as well. Can you explain the situation? What to let go of? Again, let go of wanting something more. That's good enough. You've had a great day of meditation. Have a lot of happiness. Isn't that good enough? Other people will say, oh, that's wonderful. I wish I could do that. What does she want something more for? This is unfair. So be content with what you have. Don't want any more. This is more than good enough. And when you give up, don't want any more, this is more than enough for me, then you get the next stage. Can you please say something about what real kindness actually is? One of the things I've noticed, I mean, people actually, they don't copy each other, but so often I've found that one evening is two or three questions exactly the same. Because when you're meditating together, you're thinking together. You're reading each other's minds without you realizing it. Aside from Ajahn Gandho and Ajahn Liam, which other living, soft-hearted monks you have great respects for? I love hearing their stories. A nice soft monk. Oh yeah, I know this really, really soft monk. Really beautiful. And he doesn't live that far away. It's called Ajahn Teddy Bear. And he's right here. He's just so soft and lovely. So you can actually go and have an interview with Ajahn Teddy Bear afterwards. Because a lot of times I don't see many senior monks now because I'm senior myself. And so when I give, and with other people, I'm the one who has to give the talk. So it's very hard in my stage of monastic life to see other monks and to see other teachers. So basically I don't really know that many. Dear Ajahn, kangaroo fence is not working.
why not grow a good lawn patch with sprinklers so that they become part of JHR residents? It's a nice spectacle. They could be our relatives in their past lives. Yes, but there's sprinklers there already. And there's lots of grass outside. See how much grass there is in the paddocks, in the forest. There's acres. Why do they want to go and eat my lawn? So they can be neighbours, but outside. So, yeah, it's nice having cows and kangaroos and stuff like that, but do you really want kangaroos to be your neighbours? If you do, I'll put them in your cottage. And then see what you say. So, no, because the thing with the kangaroos is when they actually eat the grass and there's, you know, just a small area, they actually pull it out by the roots. So they actually destroy the lawn. It's only a small area. In actually the bigger paddocks, they actually graze. They eat a bit here, they eat a bit there, they nibble it. The stuff over there, they pull out. And that's why there's big empty patches. So they're destroying it. They're destroying even their own food supply. So that's why we just keep them off. There's plenty of other stuff out there for them. They'll be fine. But they're destroying it for themselves and for others. Dear Ajahn Brahm, yesterday, the story of Ananda, he seems to go through depression first and then you get enlightened. Does depression and letting go mean the same? What's the difference? I've been depressed before. It's a total disinterest in doing anything, even living. Does it feel like that when you let go? Of course not. So, now, him, he had energy. He wasn't depressed. He was more like frustrated. You know, he got lots of energy. You have the energy, but you don't know where to put it and how to use it. And this is where, you know, he just gave up. The other example, the Ananda method, when I say this, I always tell Danny or Robert to lock the storeroom where there's any ropes. Because there's a story of the nun. 7 years she was a nun. How long have you been as a nun, Prasada? Yeah. Okay, so you're safe. How long have you been a nun? 7 years? Okay, 8. Okay, so that's okay. You've gone past it. So 7 year, you know, problem. 7 years she was a nun. Not once did she have any peace in her meditation. Not once. And after 7 years not getting any success in her meditation, as a bhikkhuni, she thought, what's the point? No, I can't do it. Something wrong with me. And she didn't want to return to lay life. And so what alternative was there? So she got a rope, went into the forest, climbed a tree, tied one end of the rope onto a branch, the other around her neck, and was about to commit suicide. And just as she was about to jump off, that's when she got the first peaceful experience of her life. Now letting go. She totally, no, not really depressed. Well, she's not depressed in one sense. But, you know, just about to totally let go. I just had enough. I'm giving up. And that giving up, she just pressed the letting go button. And had a beautiful experience. And so then she was on the path. Not recommended. We cannot afford the insurance. And you try that and it might not work for you. Then I'm in big trouble. But you can actually see what was going on. You know, that somehow when your back's against the wall, you've got nothing to do, then you have to let go. When I had all those mosquitoes on me, I had no choice. It was either real big time suffering or let go. So you couldn't be lazy. Or like sometimes people when they got cancer and then they come on a retreat, they really meditate because it's life and death for them. So, no, but if you haven't got cancer, no, you've got, you know, you may be getting on, but, you know, you've got a few more years left in you. It's only the third day or fourth day or something. There's plenty more days to go. It doesn't really matter. But when you really have to, it's amazing you can. And one last question, then we'll finish off. It's almost 9:30. If mindfulness leads to nimitta, which leads to the jhanas, then what's the difference between teaching mindfulness and teaching the jhanas?
It's not just mindfulness. It's where you put the mindfulness and how strong is the mindfulness. So that's why we teach jhanas. Tell a really strong mindfulness, super mindfulness, super power mindfulness, bliss, power, all born of letting go. That's why I teach it. Good fun. If you never heard a description of the jhanas, you will still experience them through a mindfulness practice. Not just the mindfulness practice, a letting go practice, kindness, virtue, you need the whole eightfold path. Not just mindfulness. You all know mindfulness is the seventh factor of the eightfold path. There's another seven factors above that, before that and after that. It's not just mindfulness. It's not a one-fold path. The Buddha was very compassionate. If he could have taken one or two factors off the path to make it easy for you, he would have done. This is the minimum, without any extra fat on the path, pared down to the absolute minimum requirement for enlightenment. Eight factors is what's necessary. So sometimes people think, oh, yeah, I need to be mindful. I don't need to have any precepts. I can steal and murder and do whatever I like. Now, sometimes people say that with precepts. Well, no, alcohol, no, just a bit of wine, just a little bit. That's not going to hurt, is it? And so I tell them, well, okay, you know, just a little bit of murder is okay. A little bit of stealing. Why is it always a little bit only applies to the fifth precept? Is that even a little bit impairs your awareness. And you know what the old saying is, the man takes a drink, then the drink takes a drink, then the drink takes a man. Always start off with just a tiny bit. Always thinking you're in control. Gambling. Oh, I'm in control. I'm just having a bit of a play. And then you've lost all your money. And really be careful with gambling, because just two or three weeks ago, did a funeral for a poor girl, Thai girl. She lost 100,000. Now, started little bits and borrowed money here, borrowed money there, gambling. And when she got to the 100,000, she realized she's not ever going to pay this back, so killed herself. That's just so sad. The gambling led to her death. So please, you know, don't think you're in control. Gambling is an addiction. So anyway, that's, you need the whole eightfold path. And that's it for tonight, folks. I don't know if I made any, there's still a lot of questions in here, but never mind. If the karma is ripe, they'll be answered tomorrow. If not, never mind. So, and anyone who wants to borrow the teddy bear will be up here. And actually, really, honestly, it works. And the two teddy bears, you can actually run and get it, meditate here. Or if you can't sleep tonight, you always have a hard time sleeping, you can take it to your bed and cover it in your bed tonight. It's really helpful. But please bring it back tomorrow morning. Are you taking it? Yeah. Okay. So, I forgot. Three sadhus. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Okay, good night, everyone.